My PhD thesis looked at early perceptions of the film actor in Britain during the silent period. Although one of the things I became interested in while researching that was the performance culture more generally surrounding early cinema, and that's what this talk is about today. Specifically the way cinema grew up, that is, established its distinctive media identity as part of a culture of performance and popular entertainment. One of the things I want to suggest today is that the institution cinema has always incorporated and sometimes generated live performance practices, even as film as a medium has tended to be defined in opposition to the live and the theatrical. In spite, and perhaps because of, film status as an archival medium, something that can only show us things that happened then and there rather than here and now, film history gives us plenty of examples of attempts to push at, overcome, or in a phrase that was current in the silent period, to get over the barrier between film world and audience world represented by the screen. Filmmakers, publicists, and exhibitors worried often during the 1910s and 1920s whether a particular actor would succeed in getting over to the public, making the transition from film space to picture theatre space, or whether his or her performance and personality would fall foul of the various processes of technological and cultural mediation at work. Getting over was an important concern not just in relation to film, but also for other new media practitioners of the age. C.A. Lewis, the BBC's first organiser of programmes, wondered in 1925 if the potential stars of radio would be able to develop what he described as microphone personality in order to get over when broadcasting. The performance practices I'm discussing today focus attention explicitly on the relation between live and mediated modes of presence. My examples are all taken from the British silent cinema, although I'd be interested to hear how they might resonate with cinemas from other national and historical contexts. I'm using the term live fairly indiscriminately today to refer to performances that occur when performers and their intended audiences are present together in the same place at the same time. But it's worth noting that terms like live performance and liveness were not ones that early film audiences had access to, even though we often find early film commentators reaching for a similar lexicon. As Philip Auslander points out, the concept of liveness has only become meaningful with the advent of mechanical and electronic technologies of recording and reproduction, and with the gradual mediatisation of performance culture that these technologies have brought about. So one of the things that I hope will emerge from this talk today and from further work on the performance practices of silent cinema is a sense of how notions of live and mediated presence developed in tandem, variously informing, defining and complicating each other over time. I said before that cinema grew up in a performance culture. For this, I suppose I mean in the first instance that cinema, or rather the technology of the cinematograph, was first housed in venues and institutional frameworks that were already associated with traditions of popular performance: music halls, variety theatres, lecture rooms, fairgrounds. As a variety turn, the technology of moving or animated pictures shared the bill with singers, dancers, acrobats, magicians, comic sketches, dramatic monologues and other live acts for much of its early history. The content of early films also borrowed eclectically from existing performance traditions, as did the showmen and women who first exhibited them, many of whom had backgrounds in novelty shows, public lecturing or magic lantern demonstrations. In seeking to describe the distinctive character of film's first decade or so, film historians have gravitated towards a phrase coined by Tom Gunning and Andre Godrio, the cinema of attractions, in acknowledgement of moving pictures' place in the mixed bill of popular urban and travelling entertainments. Over the course of the 1900s and 1910s, cinema gradually acquired its own institutional identity, including its own exhibition venues. By 1914, there were about 4,000 dedicated picture theatres in Britain. But even within these specialist venues, there was still room for a mixed programme of films and live acts. Some of these live acts were designed to add variety to the evening's entertainment. Others were designed specifically to support or enhance the effect of the films being screened. Probably the most important live performers in picture theatres, and certainly the most ubiquitous, were the musicians engaged to accompany or play to the films being projected, setting the tone, explicating the action, and masking the human and mechanical noises of the picture theatre auditorium Live music became a central part of the cinematic experience. Less widespread than the film musician, but still common up to about 1910, was the film lecturer or narrator, who provided spoken commentaries to explain or interpret the events unfolding on screen. And the first set of performance practices I want to focus on in a bit more detail relates to these attempts to support or enhance the effect of the films being shown. Amongst the services that film lecturers offered exhibitors and audiences was the skill of supplying voices for on-screen characters, either by reading out written intertitles or by scripting or improvising their own interpolated dialogue. Some exhibitors made a speciality of voicing silent films in this way. In 1910, Mr. Dove Patterson, proprietor of the Gaiety Theatre in Aberdeen, hired, and later married, Miss Marie Pascoe, a former stage and film performer, to help him make the pictures speak. Rehearsing their parts on Monday afternoons, the couple provided vocal accompaniment to that evening's programme. This live act, known as the Gaiety Elocutionists, lasted for several years and became a regular and popular part of the venue's exhibition format. Like lecturers, the Gaiety Elocutionists became authors of their own multimedia or intermedial texts, ventriloquising and, in a sense, standing in for the figures appearing on the screen. Bringing film actors themselves to cinemas for live personal appearances also became a feature of early producers' and exhibitors' marketing strategies during the 1910s. Early examples of personal appearances in UK cinemas include a visit made by two actors from the US film company Edison to a cinema in London in 1913. A journalist for one of the film trade papers recorded the event in detail, and in terms it suggests how personal appearances could function as part of a carefully orchestrated cinematic event. These are extracts from the trade journal, The Bioscope. During a recent evening performance at that well-known rendezvous, the Marble Arch Palace, a neat little surprise was given to the crowded audience. In the midst of a fine programme, an extra picture was announced, the fine Edison release, The Gauntlets of Washington. The drama was followed with a rapt attention and, enhanced by special orchestral effects, evoked a big round at its close. Then it was seen that something was astir, and the manager of the palace announced that on that evening, they were favoured with the presence of two of the greatest photo players who had very often appeared on their screens. Only a little while ago, they had appeared there in the two portraits. He alluded to Mr. Mark McDermott and Miss Miriam Nesbitt. Amid loud applause, Mr. McDermott, a fine, bronzed, athletic fellow, just like the picture, as one lady remarked, stepped before the screen and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I thank you very much for your reception. I have, I dare say, appeared here a good many times in the spirit, but I can assure you that it affords me much pleasure to appear before you in the flesh." Miss Nesbitt, whose features would, we are sure, put to blushing shame many of our vaunted postcard beauties, briefly thanked the audience and said, "It is my first visit to this fine theatre, but I certainly hope it will not be my last. I also know, as Mr. McDermott remarked, that I have appeared before you on the screen. I only hope that I may be spared to appear before you for many summers to come." On this occasion, film space and picture theatre space were suggestively brought together for the cinema audience. Screening of a film drama enhanced by orchestral accompaniment gives way to or summons up the unexpected and spectacular manifestation of picture actors in the flesh. At the same time, the two spaces of film and picture theatre were held apart by the visible and tangible contrast between the actors' virtual screen images and the real, physical, not to mention bronzed and athletic, presence of the actors' bodies on stage. I think one thing that a lot of these live picture theatre performances have in common is that ability to suggest proximity on the one hand, while simultaneously reinforcing a sense of distance between film and film viewer on the other. A more elaborate attempt to use personal appearances as part of an integrated multimedia spectacle can be found some years later in the staged prelude to Cecil Hepworth's 1924 film Coming Through the Rye, based on the popular novel by Helen Mathers, which was first published in 1875. The practice of including a staged prelude or prologue before high-profile film screenings became popular in Britain around 1920, following the success of the live presentation that accompanied the initial release of D.W. Griffith's film Broken Blossoms. For Griffith's film, the interior of the Alhambra Theatre was transformed into an Orientalist fantasy, complete with singing birds in glass cages hung from the proscenium arch, and a bronze god placed on the stage and illuminated with an eerie green light. Screenings were bracketed by a live prologue and epilogue, in which, according to a writer for the trade journal Kinematograph Weekly, Chinese figures perform in dumb show characteristic rites and ceremonies before an altar, under somber lighting, the whole being typical of the atmosphere of the film. Hepworth's prelude for Coming Through the Rye likewise set out to imbue the interior of the Scala Theatre of Tottenham Court Road with the atmosphere of Victorian rural England that the film itself works hard to visualise and commemorate. The stage presentation also offered audiences an opportunity to reflect on the representation abilities of the screen more generally to bring the past to life. The prelude comprised a short sketch performed before the film was screened. It featured Alma Taylor, the Hepworth Company's leading lady and the star of the film, along with several other members of the film's cast. In his autobiography, Hepworth gave an account of the performance as follows. It gave the effect of a huge picture in a gilt frame, which at first showed nothing but the ordinary title familiar on every film. This gradually dissolved into a stage scene with the living actors going silently through their parts. That dissolved into another title filling the frame to be replaced again by the appropriate scene and so on. The effect was quite magical. What Hepworth described is a kind of live reenactment of a silent film, or realisation perhaps, complete with title cards and cinematic dissolves to separate scenes. Contemporary sources suggest the magical effect Hepworth alludes to was heightened by the use of a revolving floor to make the transition between scenes as seamless as possible, and by a sheet of gauze stretched over the gilt frame, which gave a soft focus haze to the proceedings. A reviewer for the theatrical journal The Era commented, "We see through gauze a little drama in dumb show, which, because of the silence and the remoteness, has an eerie resemblance to a reality of the past glimpsed for us by means of the magic frame." Hepworth's combination of cinematic formal devices and theatrical illusion represents one extreme example of attempts to bring film space and audience space together through performance. But as I suggested before, live picture theatre performances often produce the sense of proximity and distance in equal measure. Hepworth rounds off the episode in his memoirs by recalling a complaint he'd received from an old lady who had come to see the live prelude. The old lady told Hepworth that she had come up all the way from the country to see Alma Taylor in the flesh and had, she believed, been put off with a coloured film. "I tried hard to reassure her," writes Hepworth, "that she had really seen Alma, but she would not be convinced. So I took her round to the back and introduced her to the lady, and it was rather a compliment to the effectiveness of the illusion." Hepworth's old lady, who fails to spot when a performance is really live, is like an inverse of those early film spectators who, we're told, failed to recognise when a performance was actually mediated. She's a sort of 1920s version of the country bumpkin or rube figure satirised by early filmmakers, someone who tries to join in with on-screen dances, or who runs away from the moving picture of a train. But rather than closing on this image of an audience member baffled by the tricks played by and with moving picture technology, I want to give one final example of a live picture theatre performance in which audience members played a more active role. In 1913, an enterprising cinema proprietor in Bristol launched a contest to seek out local film acting talent. This is how the Bioscope described the scheme. A somewhat novel idea was introduced the other week by Mr. Alexander Grant at the Cinema Picture Hall, Castle Street, Bristol. It consisted of a picture actors' contest run on original lines. The Vitagraph film A Woman was chosen as a subject, two particular scenes being acted by the competitors. The lady and gentleman winning each evening acted the scenes again to the camera, and on the Saturday, the pictures were shown on the screen for the final judging. In this example, cinema goers are first cast as live performers imitating film actors, giving a live reenactment of moving pictures, before being cast again as film actors in their own right, being projected for the entertainment of other patrons. Across this week-long process, cinema goers were also called upon to act as witnesses and consumers of the dizzying or liberating circulation of performances from film space to picture theatre space and back again. Whilst this particular picture actors contest seems to have been a one-off, the practice of staging what we might call live screen tests as entertainment was taken up by a number of exhibitors and publicists during the silent period. Getting over the screen for the participants of these events could also mean getting onto it. So what I hope these examples have shown is the diversity of live performance practices that film grew up with and that continue to coexist with film during its transition from music hall and fairground to dedicated picture theatre. I also hope these examples have shown how live performances could serve to support and enhance cinematic effect, even as they threaten to distract it from it or to compete with it for audience attention. Finally, I hope these examples have suggested ways that we might begin to rethink the relationship between cinema and live performance by paying attention not just to their differences and the way they're often defined in opposition to each other, but also to the productive and ongoing overlaps between the two.